Hi, I'm Nathan Ryder, and welcome to the Viva Survivors podcast, where I talk to PhD graduates about their research, their Viva, and life after the PhD. This is episode 4, and today I'm talking with Dr. Julia Collins, a PhD maths graduate of the University of Edinburgh. Julia had a Viva in 2011, and since then has had the position of Mathematics Engagement Officer for Edinburgh. Her stuffed sheep haggis blogs about maths and science communication, haggisandsheep.wordpress.com. And you can also follow them both on Twitter by following haggismaths. Julia, tell me a little bit about your research. What did you do for your PhD?
So my thesis was in an area of maths called topology, and it's the branch called knot theory. And I was investigating knots and surfaces in four dimensions. And the thesis had, well, there was a particular conjecture that a certain type of knot couldn't exist. And I was trying to prove the conjecture. So I never quite got there, but I got some of the way.
For new listeners, I was also a knot theorist when I was doing my PhD. So
it's a good subject. How close?
Yeah, it's brilliant. How close did you get?
I never got a big kind of trying to find maybe a counterexample. If the conjecture was false, there had to be a counterexample. So I tested like 3,000 knots, and I had a theorem and a computer program to implement the theorem, and none of them were counterexamples, but there were three possibilities that still exist. So I've narrowed it down to three possible counterexamples.
Wow.
And I'm waiting for someone else to check if any of them work.
And so those are those counterexamples like classes of knots themselves?
No, they're particular knots that may or may not have this property that we conjectured. So,
wow.
But it's pretty hard to check, because if they do have the property, then you can only prove it by drawing a picture, and drawing pictures are really hard. You can't program that into a computer. But if it's false, there should be some theorem that you can apply which will find an invariant or something.
Yeah. How did you end up doing a PhD?
Well, I got to the end of my undergraduate degree, or at least in my fourth year of a master's, and I didn't want to stop. Like, the maths was just too interesting. I wanted to keep going and find out more maths, and the sort of wanting to contribute my own part to human knowledge. So yeah, I was just enjoying it too much to give it up, and plus I couldn't think what else I wanted to do with my life.
Yeah, I remember that feeling really well. So what happened how long did you spend, I suppose, on your PhD?
Well, I got funding for 3.5 years, and it took me 4.5 years, so I went sort of a year over what I should have done. But part of that was because I was doing all sorts of activities, which then got me the job that I was doing afterwards, so I don't regret that it took longer.
No, and we'll come back to the job in a little while. So as you were coming towards the end of your research and you were writing things up, what did you do to prepare for your Viva?
So I got my thesis and I started annotating it. So I just read through it line by line, checking that I understood every single proof that was in there. And somehow the hardest thing to do was to check the background chapters, because the proofs that I'd written myself, I understood like the back of my hand. But the proofs that were just in the literature, I'd often not really bothered reading them carefully. I just skim read them, like, okay, that's fine. So that was a large part of my preparation, was making sure I understood all the literature that my thesis was based on. And just annotating the thesis and drawing pictures of everything and convincing myself I actually understood what the hell I'd done.
So did you have a large bibliography?
Oh, I don't know what counts as large. I can't remember. Probably about average. But there's particular key papers where you know that there's just some big theorem that your whole work depends on. But it's such a big theorem that you never bothered reading the proof because it was too difficult.
What else did you do then to prepare?
That was my main preparation, really. I'm not sure what else I could have done to prepare.
Did you get advice from other people about your Viva or about preparing for it?
Not so much. I guess I knew who my examiners were, so one of them was really an expert in my field, so I checked out the latest few papers that he'd written to see, where he was coming from and what questions he might ask me. I just ask other people, and they always just said, don't panic, it'll be fine.
Nobody tried to scare you then?
No.
You have much nicer friends than I do. Did you ever have a mock Viva?
Nope.
No? Did you sit down at all with your supervisor? And?
Not really. I mean, my supervisor didn't really know what I'd written in my thesis anyway. I mean, so, you know, he didn't give me particularly much advice.
Okay. Well, let's move on to sort of thinking about the Viva itself then. A week before the Viva, what sort of things were you feeling? Do you remember?
I was alternating from one day to the next between going, I can do this, I've got a great thesis, it'll be fine, and the next day going, I don't understand anything, I'm going to fail, it's going to be horrible. So just very emotionally, like, you know, on a roller coaster. And actually, it was about, I don't know, 4 days before the Viva, I was reading through one of my proofs and realised that it was incomplete and there was a huge gap in this proof. So then that was panic mode setting in, and I had, like, you know, a few days to figure out the actual proof, which I did.
Yeah.
So that was, and once I did that, there's just this huge sense of relief, like, okay, that's the worst thing that could have happened, is that my proofs were wrong, that's not going to happen anymore, I'll just relax. So yeah, a bit of a roller coaster the week before.
Yeah, I can imagine. What did you take with you into the Viva?
The big fat annotated thesis that I'd got, because it just had all of these clarifications of, you have to remember why this proof works, or little diagrams, or just extra stuff that probably I hadn't had time to write in the thesis. That was the main thing. I think maybe I took my favourite textbook in as well, in case I needed to look anything up. And my sheep haggis for moral support.
I thought this was going to be a good to bring in haggis. Can you explain or tell us a little bit about haggis? Because haggis has his own online presence as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's become quite a personality in my life. He's just my toy stuffed sheep. But I use him as a kind of mouthpiece for my public engagement. So when I give talks to school kids, as you say, he has a blog about science communication and his own Twitter feed and everything. So I took him along to the Viva just to reassure me that it wasn't quite so difficult.
You didn't get any help from him during the Viva?
I didn't, no. He didn't have, like, answers stapled to his forehead or anything. But he was just there. I got a photo of him with my examiners afterwards. It was all good fun.
That's excellent. And I'll put a link to Julia's or Haggis's Twitter feed.
I just do the typing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'll put links to those in our show notes.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your Viva. How did it? What was your feeling as it started?
I was a bit nervous when it started. I made sure I had coffee 15 minutes before, so that the caffeine would kick in just when it started. That was a good idea. But my two examiners were both really, really lovely guys and quite young as well. So they made me feel very relaxed. And we started off with a presentation. So I was asked to give a short presentation summarising the main results of my thesis and saying why it was important. And so I prepared, about 15 minutes worth of slides. But they interrupted me the whole way through I was talking. So what was meant to be a 15-minute presentation turned into maybe the first 45 minutes of the Viva, of them just making sure they understood where I was coming from.
Yeah.
And all the basic definitions in my thesis.
Yeah, I had a similar experience actually, because I was asked to do a presentation and produce some slides, but my presentation ended up becoming my Viva.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I might have told you that before, and so I was just stood in front of a blackboard for quite a while.
But I think it's okay, because it does relax you, because you know you've prepared that bit of it, so the questions are not that unexpected, and it does relax you a bit before they start asking anything difficult.
So what was the format of your Viva like then after you finished your presentation?
It felt like just a little seminar. There was just the two of them and me in a little seminar room. I had a blackboard and the presentation screen. And they were just sort of, they had the thesis in front of them, and they obviously had done their own annotation, so they were just asking me about any proofs they didn't understand, or maybe a definition that I'd not got quite right. So basically we're just working through the thesis from chapter one. Okay. We spent a lot of the time on the background chapters, and that's maybe something I hadn't prepared as much. I was really expecting them to go straight into, here are your results, can you explain your results to us and clarify your own proofs? But the questions I found the most difficult in the end were the ones of, like, all the background material, which you think you understand until somebody asks you about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can really relate to that. I have nightmares about that.
There were some questions that they asked which they didn't even know the answers to, and we had to go away and look it up afterwards or ask somebody else. So wow. It's not like they're not trying to catch me out or anything. They genuinely just wanted to understand what was going on.
Were there any stressful moments, or did it really just feel like a high-level sort of conversation?
No, it just felt like a conversation. It didn't feel like an exam, absolutely not. And it's like it was 4 hours. Like, we started at 2 and we finished at 6 just because we were getting hungry. And I felt like we could have easily gone on for another 4 hours.
Wow.
The time just went so quickly because you're talking about the subject that you've been doing for such a long time and you love it. Two people are there who are interested in hearing about it, and so it absolutely didn't feel like an exam.
Do you think it was one of the most in-depth conversations you've had about your research?
About the thesis, definitely.
Yeah.
But that's the point of it. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And especially because, like, say, my supervisor in the end didn't really understand my proofs, and I had a second supervisor, honorary supervisor in America, who I hadn't spoken to for quite a long time before the Viva. So I'd gone 6 months without talking to anybody about my results. So it was really refreshing to get into the Viva and have two people who wanted to hear about it.
Yeah. Did you have a long time between when you submitted and when you had your Viva?
About 1 month.
Okay.
It was long enough to prepare. I don't think I would have wanted it any longer.
Were there any stressful moments in the Viva?
I guess there were a few of these background questions which I knew that I couldn't answer, and we stumbled around a bit, and I felt a bit stupid for not knowing it. So I guess that was the worst bit.
Okay. How did you feel after it was finished, when they said, well, how did it end, I suppose?
I think they just got hungry and they're like, oh, we should probably stop now. Because I was just like in the middle of it. Like, we hadn't even got halfway through my results and they were ready to stop. And I was like, do you not want to know about all these results in my next chapter? So it felt like it ended very soon, even though it was 4 hours.
So then
I think I felt quite relieved afterwards. And then, like, within 15 minutes, they'd come back to say, yeah, you've passed minor corrections.
Okay. And what sort of corrections... were they? What sort of things did they ask you to do?
A lot of the small typos and a few proofs that they just wanted me to write a couple of extra lines of clarification or things like that. So there was no big rewriting of anything.
And how long did that take you to complete those?
I did it within a week, but partly because I had the deadline that if I wanted to graduate in the summer, I had to hand in the corrections by the end of that week.
Okay.
So that was a bit of a stretch, actually, because there were quite a few of these small corrections. But I'm glad I got it done quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and the other thing, after the Viva, that I was actually really annoyed at my examiners because they hadn't spotted this massive hole in my proof. And I thought, well, if you didn't even notice that, then I could have published that and you would never have told me it was wrong. So that's actually, it's a bit of annoyance.
So what have you been doing since you finished your PhD? So that was about a year ago that you had your Viva.
Yeah, it was the 11th of May, so nearly a whole year. So I'd done a lot of stuff in the last couple of years of my PhD in public engagement, so like going out to schools and giving talks, running masterclasses, helping out at science festivals. And so by the end of my PhD, the department realised actually I was quite useful and they wanted somebody like me to be doing that. So they kept employing me. So it was brilliant. So now I spend a third of my time doing public engagement, like, you know, running festival exhibitions and talking in schools. I do a third of my time is undergraduate lecturing, which I also love. You just get the chance to be so creative. No one tells you how you're supposed to teach. And then the rest of my time is kind of publicising the research that we do in the department here in Edinburgh. So writing a website and trying to organise business interactions and that kind of high-level stuff.
So what kind of things have you and Haggis done for public engagement?
Well, we just had the Edinburgh Science Festival, so we had an exhibition for a week, well, like an interactive exhibition about statistics and courtroom, like forensic courtroom statistics, which was lots of fun. And we're off to Dumfries in a couple of weeks to do a talk. And I like talking to school kids about knot theory because it is a really current area of maths. And it's about, you know, you can draw pictures and it's geometry and it's not the kind of maths that kids would learn at school. So I'm going to go and tell some S4, which is year 10, all about my thesis subject.
So 14, 15-year-olds.
Yeah. So in Scotland they're doing their highers, which is sort of like GCSEs.
Okay. Okay. How has your PhD helped you to do what you do now? So I suppose in some sense you couldn't or it'd be very unlikely for you to lecture to undergrads unless you've done a PhD. But what about the other sorts of skills that you got during your PhD? How do they help?
Well, firstly, the PhD just gave me the opportunity to get out there and do all the things that I enjoy. I mean, there's lots of courses when you're a graduate student on these transferable skills. So advice on how to do public speaking, how to organise a talk or a workshop or something. So I had all of that opportunity, which I wouldn't have any other way. And I guess also just being a PhD student, you're exposed to so many different areas of math and you meet lots of interesting people that it's then very easy to go out and tell other people about what you do. Being a PhD student means that you have to be very independent all of the time. Like when you're an undergraduate, you just have a routine that you have the problem sheets every week. You know exactly which part of the course you're going to have to use to solve each problem sheet. And then suddenly you're a PhD student and you've just got all of maths and you can use any of it and you don't even know where to get started half the time. So I think PhD certainly teaches you to work on your own independently, be self-sufficient. And I guess that's helpful in any job, not just what I'm doing. But I'm certainly very used to organising my own work and not being dictated to of how I should teach or what kind of talk I should give or anything like that.
I think that's a really good point that you've raised there. Have you got any advice that you might give to people on this independence and how to embrace that and be really independent as a postgraduate researcher?
Yeah, because that's certainly one of the hardest things I found about being put into a PhD is that you're lost in the information. You don't know what to do. And one of the things that I learned, it took me a long time to learn, is to ask for help when you get stuck and not just spend hours and hours at your desk not knowing what you're meant to be doing or what this proof means. So learning to ask for help is important. And I guess just learning to be confident that I think when you start your PhD, you feel like everyone else knows more than you do and you must be the stupid one for not understanding. And you find that actually they've just worked very hard at learning this stuff and they've done it for a long time and that's why they know it. So yeah. Learning to have confidence in your own abilities. And yeah, don't feel stupid when you don't understand something, but learn to ask for help.
That's really great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Is there any advice you'd give someone who has almost finished their PhD and is preparing for their viva?
Well, firstly, don't worry about the viva. Right? You are the world expert in your thesis topic. So that's not something that you have to worry about. And your viva is something that you should enjoy. It's a chance for you to talk about the subject that you should, at that point, love the most. But also, like, when you're finishing up your thesis, if you're writing up and wanting to hand in, like, don't be a perfectionist. Your examiners won't pick up on all the niggly things that have annoyed you or that you think are not quite right. They'll pick up on things that you never even would have thought about. So don't spend ages and ages dithering before handing it in. Just do it, get it finished. And if there's anything that needs changing, your examiners will tell you about it after the viva.
Yeah.
It's very easy to be a perfectionist. Like, your thesis is never finished. At some point, you just give up and you just hand it in.
Yeah, I still feel that way about mine, and I think it's nearly 4 years since I had my viva, and it does feel... I'm very happy with it, but it does feel like it was eventually abandoned.
There's always more that you can do.
Yeah.
So you just have to stop somewhere.
And maybe that's a good place to stop. any final thoughts, Julia? Or have we covered it?
I don't think so. I think I've said everything I wanted to say.
Okay, well... Okay, so thank you very much for taking part today, Julia. It's been really great catching up with you and hearing about what you have been doing, what your viva was like, and what you and Haggis are doing now.
It's been great talking to you too.
That was episode 4 of Viva Survivors. Thanks to Julia for her time. Be sure to check out details of the great engagement projects that she's been involved with at haggistthesheep.wordpress.com. If you've got questions about the viva, comments about the podcasts, or want to contribute to future episodes, then email me at podcast@viva-survivors.com. I'm Nathan Ryder. Thanks for listening.